Righty. I'm Lori, I'm an alcoholic. And I'm going to open with, I am not a public speaker. And I got the phone call when we were at CVS getting water. We had made it to the mountain, ready to relax. And then you get the phone call. And it's like, Tony, call me. This is Tony, call me back. And that is never a good sign. Because if it was really good news, he would have left the message. And I'm like, all righty then, here we go. My sobriety date is January 30th, 1995, and for that I am truly grateful. And it is a loving higher power, my God, and this program that and great sponsorship that keeps me in this deal on a daily basis. I'm going to take you on a journey. I know some people say how it was, how it is. I don't know. I have a tendency to jump around a little bit, so just try and keep up. My husband and I will be having a conversation, and he'll go, now, we were at what, who, on, so, you know, you're just going to have to bear with me. I'm hopefully going to get to the point of it all. But all I can do is start at the beginning. I am the third of four children. I was raised in Bellevue, Washington. It's right outside of Seattle. When I lived there, it was a little suburb. We had Stradley's Woods across the street. My mom was an RN and worked at the community hospital, and my dad was in charge of quality control for Pacific Northwest Bell, which is now AT&T. They both, my dad worked 30 years and retired, and my mom worked 20-something and retired. I grew up in a pretty normal household. And I'm going to say some things that I just have come to believe over the years, and you can take it with a grain of salt and move on. But some of these have become my beliefs. And one of them is that you can drink or drug and go over a line and just have done it too long. I think that there's also a hereditary factor to it. And there was alcohol on both sides of my family. My grandfather was a violent alcoholic on my dad's side. The only thing that I really remember about him is he sat in a green leather crack chair, you know those ones from like 1950? And he had a cigarette in one hand and a drink in the other and long yellow fingernails. And that's really all I remember about him. But my dad tried to get my mom, grandmother, to move away and get a place for years. And she just, women didn't do that back then. She stayed and worked in a bakery and supported him. And on my mom's side, she had five brothers. And some of them were probably more destined for this program. They all drank, because good Irish Catholics do. When my grandmother passed away, my uncle came down 6'4" with a lampshade on his head. You know, that's just what we did. But other than that, my mom and dad, I mean, other than a drink before dinner, glass of wine before dinner, I could probably count the times on one hand that I ever saw my parents drunk. And that was probably from a Christmas party at work or the next door neighbors. You know, none of that was prevalent in our home. So, and out of the four of us, my I have two brothers and a sister. Out of the four of us, three of us have found our way, or probably should have found our way into this program, but I'm not taking their inventory. And one of them is so much in need of Al-Anon. But bless her heart, she works hard at taking care of mom, and I, you know, can't fault her for that today. So, but anyways, you know, it was all pretty, you know, normal. And I say that, and I'm gonna coattail on my husband, and I know it's supposed to be all about me, but I always like to bring this up, and that is that alcohol doesn't care. It just doesn't care. And it will take from you every time. And he grew up in an abusive home in Arkansas and picked cotton and grew up really poor. But you know what? We both walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, on our knees at our lowest point, and it just doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how much money you have. It doesn't, none of that matters. So, Anyway, so I was always smart in school. It was easy for me. PE class was not. I was round. I had strawberry blonde hair and freckles. I could not climb the rope, and because of that, I got, I don't want to say low self-esteem, but I was really shy, because I did excel when it came to reading and math and all that stuff. I was in accelerated classes, and even in elementary school. But when I got into high school, it was different, and I wanted to be a part of. And even though I was still shy, I was the friend of the girlfriend that was dating just almost the cutest guy in school. So I had connections. I just couldn't ever quite get there. I always had a very close friends and stuff. I never was really one of those ones that went to the parties and stuff. But I started working when I was 17 at Jack in the Box. And there was him, the shift manager. And anyways, one thing led to another. And we were going out to breakfast and this and that and the other. And pretty soon, one of my friend's grandfather had a little cabin on the coast. And we all went over there. And the first time I got drunk, it was on vodka and lime sherbet. And they talk about wine. Anyways, and the first time I drank, I passed out on the bottom bunk. And that was just the beginning. And I often think that somewhere inside of me there was, some four-leaf clovers just waiting for alcohol to be sprinkled on them so we could find the pot of gold. And alcohol was my pot of gold. It just made me feel more a part of. And the people that I hung with, they were drinkers, I mean, oftentimes I would have people it was more about the people I worked with. I was pretty good at hiding it from my family. But they would say, you could probably do a lot more at work, I mean, you'd probably excel a lot better if you didn't drink so much. But that just didn't really bother me. And so it was just a procession of one job after the other. You'd stay at this place, and I'd get to be like a shift manager, and then I'd go to the next place, and I'd be a restaurant manager, and then I'd get knocked back to shift manager or assistant manager, and then I'm a restaurant manager again. And it was just kind of like that all through my 20s. But as it progressed, so did my drinking. And some of those places I was asked to leave. Two of them I was fired from. Alcohol was always my thing. It was the 70s and 80s, so in Seattle, drugs were prevalent. It's not a big part of my story. If I was going to the party, I'm taking a half gallon of whiskey, but whatever you brought was fine. I just didn't have the nerve to go get it. Sometimes I'd sit in the car. Once in a while, I'd go in if it was like some of the easier stuff, but. It was just easier to go to the liquor store. So that was my deal. And I didn't really care for the side effects of some of the other stuff. But by the time I was 27, I was a daily drinker. I mean, it was, and in the restaurant business, it's really easy. I mean, I always think of that movie Cocktail, where he talks about, working all night and then having a few comatose hours of the day. And that was pretty much my life. I'd work until 12 or 1 or 2, and then drink until 4 or 5 or 6 or 7, and sleep for a couple hours and get up and do it all over again the next day. And that was my life. And I didn't think there was anything unusual about it. And I didn't think I was an alcoholic because I had a job and a car and a roof over my head. Now, the roof over my head might change about every year or 2 years. Because I was asked to leave a few of those places, too, because they didn't like the parties that I held. It was okay. I that was the one thing. People talk about how early on they knew they were alcoholic and they knew there were problems. I never knew. I knew I was having fun. I mean, we did things like, try and watch the airplanes land and go over the fence. And I was not athletic, so we got caught. just couldn't get that last part of me over the fence. Anyways, you know, and I had a DUI. I only had one. I was lucky, and I honestly believe that my higher power was there every minute of the day. I did a three, I don't know if any of you are real familiar with Seattle. Of course, the traffic was not as bad as it is now. There was a little ice on the road, and I was driving home. It was probably 2 or 3 at night, and I was pretty inebriated, and I hit my brakes and did a 360 in the middle of I-5. And just went around and kept going. I was like, that was close. Did I think about not drinking the next day? Oh, no. I was lucky. I was good. And when I got the DWI, they didn't even put me in a jail cell. They took me in the back, and I was crying, and it was Halloween, and I had drank everything under the sun. And I can't even remember what I blew. I want to say it was like a 2-point. It was high. But they didn't put me, they just sat me there and in the office. And then after that, my lawyer came in. I hired a lawyer, and it was $500. That was back in the day. And he went in there, and I had to pay a fine, and that was it. I didn't even have to go into the courtroom. He went in there for me. I stood outside, and he came and told me. So, you know, there wasn't a lot of consequences to my actions. And what I've come to realize after raising or being involved with the other side of the family, where I see the levels of alcoholism due to hereditary, when you don't have consequences, it's tough to get alcoholics to say that they have a problem. The only problems I was really having was the loss of jobs. And towards the end, when you have somebody who's good with numbers and has access to a lot of cash and piddles a little in other substances and drinks like I did and likes to go to taverns and shoot pool and throw darts, you have a tendency to get kind of creative with the financing at the places that you work. I'm going to put it that way. So anyways, the last job that I worked in Seattle, the gentleman told me, he said, you know, you're either going to have to pay this back. First, he gave me a chance to pay it back. And you would think under those circumstances, surely the girl's going to quit. Nope. So the second time he caught me finagling things, he said, you know, you're either going to pay this back or you're going to prison. Because it was enough. So I had to make the long drive out to Bellevue to these two people who had worked their whole lives and done absolutely nothing wrong and saved their money and asked them to pay this money. Well, my older brother, and I'll mention him a little later, was already in prison. And I don't know if my parents just didn't want to send another one of the kids there, but they told me that they needed to talk it over and they would let me know. And the next day they called me and my dad said, yeah, I'll cash in one of the CDs and we're going to take care of this. And before it was all over, they were blaming the company I was working for. Surely they're taking advantage of me. And I might want to see a psychiatrist. My mother mentioned it once. I did not see the psychiatrist. At that point, I had to find another job, and a friend of mine was going to work for the Army Air Force Exchange Service. They managed the Burger Kings and the PXs and stuff on base. And they were looking for people. And I, for some reason, he didn't tell them what had happened with me. And I got a job working for, I was on federal installations. And went to work for them, and they sent me to, my first duty station was Panama City, Florida. Yeah, that was fun. So I went down there, and we were building a Burger King down there. They had put one on post, and I'll tell you, after that go-around, I was pretty good for about 7 months. Because I didn't know anybody, and I didn't know the lay of the land, so I kind of held back a little. I can remember spending Thanksgiving there, me, a turkey leg, and some mashed potatoes, and nobody else. That was a moment of clarity, starting to be a moment of clarity for me. I'm like, you know, I'm here all alone. But anyway, so then after that, I worked there, and then they sent me to Fort Gordon, Georgia. After that, and I ended up becoming the restaurant manager there eventually. And it didn't take me long to find a few sergeants that liked to drink pool and throw darts, one of them being my husband. He was getting ready to retire, and he was my drinking buddy. You know, it didn't work out so well about 3 years into the marriage, but you know, I think that, again, my higher power was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And he had took one look at him and one look at me and said, you know, I think you probably need each other, probably deserve each other. Because, you know, I had done enough. I always was raised with a higher power because we went to church every Sunday and catechism class on Wednesday. But, you know, I didn't think he wanted to have anything to do with me by that point because I had pretty much broken not every commandment. I don't think I had killed anybody at that point. But I had crossed a line with a few of them. So I just didn't think that he had much for me. And I look back at it now, and he was with me every step of the way. He was with me every step of the way. Anyways, we moved in together, and a year later got married. And it was, you know, it's funny because my assistant manager just had a thing for him. And I kept going, you know, he's been married. Well, I'm his last wife. I don't know if I should say any more than that, but it's been a few. And I said, what do you want to be married to? He's like 15 years older than you. And it took one time for him and those blue eyes. Anyways, here I am. Here I am. There's a reason why there was a few. I wasn't the only one under his spell. But anyways. It was okay. He got a job working for the Augusta Police Department, and I was still working for restaurants. Got a job on the outside off of the base, so I couldn't be transferred anywhere. And we went about our business, and we were drinking every night and going to work every day. He drank a little bit more than I did, but I could drink him under the table. So that was, I thought that was a good thing. I just wasn't an alcoholic. We went to the VFW club where the drinks were cheap and strong. And we thought we had a pretty good life. Looking back on it, we spent a whole lot of daylight hours in bars and, you know, coming out at night. It wasn't any different than when I was working at a restaurant. But that went on for 3 years. And at that point, we were on the verge of divorce. And he was on suspension from work and because somebody had, we have the same sobriety date, so I have to kind of include him in this part. And anyways, somebody had smelled alcohol on him and had gone and reported him to the police department. So they hauled him in there, and they wanted to give him a breathalyzer, and he wouldn't do that. He had to have a blood test because, you know, we alcoholics are so indignant. And not me. That was always my thing. I shouldn't put that on him. That's me all the way. Anyways, he went in and he talked to his lieutenant. His lieutenant asked him if he thought he had a problem, and he said, yeah, I think I do. And it was the first time in his life he was ever honest about it, I guess. That's what he told me. I'm going based on what he told me. But when he got up the morning to report down to his police or to the captain or whatever, he felt a wind blow through him. And from that day, he has not had a craving for alcohol after drinking until he's 42 years old. It's one of those phenomena that just happens in this program from time to time. It did not happen to me. So he went in and he went to outpatient treatment, and because I was the good wife, alcohol left our home. But you know, that was my solution. I didn't want to think, I didn't want to feel. I'm not drinking for effect. I'm drinking Boilermakers. I'm hitting the bar at 10 o'clock and I'm drinking Boilermakers to get to that place. I'm not, it's not, there is nothing social about my drinking at that point. So there it goes. And we're still not in a great place. We're still on the verge of divorce. We're not in a great place. So eventually, I tried to be an Al-Anon. I tried. Because I am a planner. But you can be a planner and be an alcoholic. And, I went to a couple meetings and I kept going, they're talking about me. Nothing. It never quite felt right. Now, when he was in treatment and I was going to family counseling, I was going to be a counselor. You know how we are. It's an all or nothing proposition. I look back on it today. I look at what Mary does. No way could I ever do that. I mean, it just takes special people to do that. I love working with sponsees, but it's not day in and day out. And there's a lot of people that you just get sad when they walk away from the program and you want it for them so bad. And I was into the fixing a little bit. So anyways, I went to a few Al-Anon meetings and finally I just got to a point where I wasn't getting any relief. I wasn't getting it from Al-Anon by any means. And I finally just hit my knees one day because I knew I couldn't live that way anymore. And it wasn't, we were living in a rented trailer with rented furniture and two drunk mobiles. And this guy had a house up here and he had a horse pasture, like a U-shape. And he had little trailers all the way around. And we lived in one of those. And in Augusta, Georgia during the summer, it just depends on which way the wind's blowing. It's either a really nice place to live or it was a not so nice place to live. But that's where we were at. And we made good money. We went in and tried to declare bankruptcy. And they wouldn't let us because they told us we made too much money. I'm like, I don't know how, Well, if you're not going to make your car payment and you're going to spend it at the bar. Anyways. And, and then the whole thing with the checks and I'm thinking I'm, the big financial girl. Anyways. So I hit my knees. And Randy came in and he gave me the name of a lady. And I was really shy back then. I mean, we're talking, I went to work, I came home, we went to the bar, we went to the grocery store. I think I had one or two friends, maybe, from work. I know I had one lady that drank like I did that I kind of hung with. But other than that, I didn't really have a whole lot in my life. But I got up and I took the lady's name and I went to a speaker's meeting. And for whatever reason, I got up. He went to a meeting. He went to his treatment meeting. And I got up and picked up a white chip. And then after that, I went over to that lady. I did not know from Adam. And I said, "Will you sponsor me?" And again, you will hear God in my story over and over again. And this is one of the biggies. She said, "Well, let me pray about it." She had 2 years in the program, and the next day she said she'd sponsor me. She was in charge of the intergroup office in Augusta, Georgia. And her name was Pat, and she was a retired Catholic nurse. So my higher power gave me just the person that I needed at that moment to bring me out of my shell and into the sunlight of the Spirit that this program had to offer. She took me to every meeting in town. We went to recovery seminars. I went to Joe and Charlie Tate. When Joe and Charlie came, we went. She took me everywhere. And at first I thought, oh my gosh, she's doing all this stuff. Well, in the last few years we've had some conversations about, that period of time. And she says, I was going from meeting to meeting because Intergroup didn't have enough money to barely keep 5 big books on the shelf. So I was going from meeting to meeting trying to drum up business so that they would support the intergroup. It had nothing to do with you. I mean, I wanted to take you to meetings. But do you see what I am? I'm all about this. I'm all about self. It's all about me. And now, 20/20 hindsight, I'm like, oh, okay, well, I'm not so important. Well, I was, but anyways. She's a wonderful lady. I still talk to her today. Matter of fact, we're talking about taking a trip to Atlanta. and making, you know, a 2-day stop to see our two first sponsors, because they are getting up in age. But they were both wonderful people. Anyway, so we go off on our course of, I go through my course of action, and I'm doing the steps, check, check, check. Kind of like the girls do at Serenity. It's not, you know, it's like school. I was good at school. I even did a 4-step where I wrote out the book. It was not a 4-column inventory, it was the book. Poor woman. And then I went to a Catholic priest because I felt it necessary. I have not done that since. He was a good guy. And he gave me some ways of making some absolution with some of the things I told him. So it was a good experience. And when I left there, I was on a pink cloud for a couple weeks. You know, I had taken some of that off of me, and anyways, and proceeded to kind of work through the rest of the steps. So I got around 9. The leveling of pride in 9, I don't know, I didn't handle that as well. And we got to be about 5 years sober, and we're on the phone. It's Christmas. Everybody's with their families. Randy's kids are in Ripley and Arkansas. And the grandkids are on the phone. And we got off the phone and took a look at each other, and we said, we need to move home. We need to be with the grandkids and the family. So it took us 1 month for him to find a job at the Memphis VA, because he was currently at that time had working for the VA in Augusta, Georgia. And of course, I was working for restaurants, so I can go anywhere. It didn't take me long to find a job. Sold our house. Yeah, by this time, 3 years into sobriety, we got a house. We sold our house and we moved to Memphis. Well, Covington, because our son told us that we needed to live just over the Tipton County line so we wouldn't have to pay Shelby County taxes. That was a mistake, but that's okay. We were there 20 years, so it's okay. But anyway, so we came to Memphis, and we... You guys didn't do it. They didn't do it right in Memphis. They didn't do the chips right. The old timers talked too long. The rooms were way too smoky. You know, we just need to spend time with family. You know, we don't need to go to so many meetings. We don't really need sponsors. But when we, right before we left, my husband's sponsor told us, he goes, I want you to think about something. You're going to be living there. You're not going to be visiting. There's not going to be any red carpet. You know, you're going to be a permanent fixture. I'm like, yeah, yeah, be fine. Well, we became the permanent fixture, and then all of the character defects started to show. And we went a few years, more than a few years, without sponsorship, without this program, without meetings. And I don't know if there's anybody in the room who's doing that, but I can tell you what my experience was, is that at 10 years sober, I hit my knees again. I had not taken a drink of alcohol, and I had every one of those character defects sitting on my shoulders. And the only reason that I probably don't have a different sobriety date is we lived so far out in the country, it took us 25 minutes to get to the grocery store. So, and I was just too lazy. So, but I got up the next day, and I went to a meeting, and there was a lady there, and I heard her share twice, and I loved what she shared, and I asked her to sponsor me, because my God takes care of me in those situations. If I go into a room and I see somebody who's worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and who's in the first 164 pages, I trust them, because I can always make a change to take me through the work. And that is also something that is very close and dear to my heart. I love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the fellowship. I'm deeply into service work. But you know what? The program of Alcoholics Anonymous is in the 164 pages. And until I've done that work, I'm not going to get any relief. I might get a little. I might get it for a minute. It might keep me in touch with not drinking so much. But I know for me, when I went through the steps that next time, that lady was moving, by the way, that I asked to sponsor me, and she put me in touch with another lady who has just about the same amount of sobriety that I do. And she helped me with some marital issues and helped me in ways she would, you know, we became more than sponsor and sponsee, we were friends. And then at that point, I had to move on to somebody who was going to hold me accountable, because now I'm not a wallflower anymore. Now I got some Irish going on. That's what I call it. And when they bother me at work and I'm not, you know, don't get my Irish up. Just, you know, so, and she started holding me accountable. And I love her to death, you know. I met her, she told me to come to this mountain. I asked her to sponsor me on this mountain. And she's ill right now. And hopefully she'll get better, but that's in God's hands right now. But anyways, but this time when I started doing the work, it wasn't a checklist anymore. It was going from my head to my heart. And that's what this program is to me. It is completely a way of living. And so badly, you know, I've lost people in my family. I had a nephew whose wife died at the age of 32 from alcoholism, not from drugs. She drank herself to death at 32. So this disease is out there alive and well. So, you know, when I go to Serenity and talk to the girls, you know, I'm just like, you know, give it 90 days, just 90 days. The carrots that'll be held out for you will be amazing. I'm working with a girl now, and I have nicknamed her the Anda girl, because every day she calls me, you know, pretty much we meet up either by phone or face almost every day, and she'll go, well, today I went to work, or today this happened, and this happened, and this. I'll be like, oh my gosh, I wish my God worked in my life the way he works in yours. I said, I know he's there, but honey, you're getting the gold. And she is doing such a good job, and that she'll keep doing it, you know? She's awesome. I've done, you know, since I've gotten sober, I have accomplished, I don't know about accomplished, my God and I have accomplished, because without him, I'm nothing. I went back to school and took a couple classes at a time, worked full time, got my BA in accounting. Then I told, we had a little, you know, prayer session, my God and I, and I said, if you give me a job where I have tuition reimbursement, I'll go back. I got a job at UT Health Science Center, and guess what they have? Tuition reimbursement. So I got my master's degree in accounting. And then the jobs that I had at UT were more administrative. I wanted to do accounting. So I saw a job at the University of Memphis that paid more. And I went and applied, and now I work in the accounting department at the University of Memphis. And I may study for my CPA, because they give a 9% increase. Not really looking to change jobs. I'm never gonna, you know, work in any big place, but, you know, we'll see. We'll see what God's got planned. And, you know, I've really done a lot as far as service work, because I believe in it, and Intergroup's my first love. They're the ones on the firing line with the literature and the telephone. And I've been involved in special events, and I was the assistant treasurer down there, and then I was the treasurer for 4 years, and I'm volunteering at the moment. That's not a long-term commitment, but for a moment. And I just do what I'm asked to do in AA. And there's one other thing I wanted to do. I know Randy says I'm getting close, but anyways. We have had a blessing in the last year, 2 months. My stepson is involved in DNA, you know, it's putting your DNA online. 1, 2, 3 DNA, and he did it, and it came back that he was had shared DNA with somebody in Texas, even more than his uncle. And so he emailed this person, and she went online a couple months later, and her last name was Brown, which is Randy's second son's last name. And I said, oh my gosh, I said, well, maybe he has a daughter he doesn't know about. But he knew about her, but that's all right. And she lives probably 30 minutes from where we lived in Covington. She probably bagged our groceries at Walmart. She worked there 3 years. But anyway, so now we have a new granddaughter, 25 years old. She's an artist, but she was on her way to moving to Atlanta. So we're going to start developing a relationship with her, and we're so excited. She's a sweetheart. And now Dad called and wants to come by Sunday afternoon. And we haven't seen him in 13 years because he is definitely one of us. We saw him 13 years ago. We wanted him to come to the house. He found out we didn't drink. Didn't want to come so much. And he probably knows we still don't drink, so we have high hopes for the weekend. Or at least I do. Randy's real good about taking it one day at a time. But it's, you know, and this is at 24 years. It's at 24 years. It's awesome. Whoever knew? I'm so excited about being in this program and seeing what else he has in store. And every time that I do this deal, I always shortchange myself. When I was in the rented trailer with the rented furniture, I never thought that I'd be in Memphis, in the home that I own, with the job that I have. And I don't have, now there's 15 people at my house on Christmas and Thanksgiving. It's not a turkey leg and mashed potatoes by myself. So this is what God has created for me to live in. And it's just awesome. I do like to read two paragraphs. I'm almost done. Mary and I share a love for the last two paragraphs in the big book on 164. And it says, our book is meant to be only suggestive. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come. If your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got, see to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road to happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. This is home for me, and I'm so thankful for the people that are here with me. Thanks.